Right, so we're almost approaching Adar, which would normally mean that we don't have so much time till Purim. But this year is a leap year. We have an extra Adar, so an extra month of Simcha, and also an extra month to learn about Purim, prepare for Purim, and get ourselves in the Purim state of mind. And this would be a good opportunity to learn the book that's the central mitzvah of the day, the Kriyas HaMegillah, reading of the Megillah, listening to the Megillah. And, you know, it's a story that I think we're all familiar with. Just ordered a children's illustrated Megillah book. It's something that's told to children. It's something that, you know, we read through every year. But, you know, depending on the speed of your Bal Koreh, so it could be, and I think maybe 18 minutes is a record. I don't know if anyone's topped that. So it could be very quick. It could be slower. But even a slow Megillah reading, you know, doesn't really give us the opportunity to, you know, delve into the text, to analyze it. You know, it's a story we've heard many times. But if you just hear the Megillah then without preparation, so we may not fully appreciate it. So just wanted to take this opportunity to, in the couple of weeks we have before Purim, to explore the Megillah a little bit deeper. And just to me, the Megillah's Esther is probably my favorite book in Tanakh. It's just a very, very, very special story. And the meaning is so significant that there's a medrash in Mishlei that says that that Purim will always be observed. Now, the commentaries on that, I mean, the Rambam also quotes this idea. And it doesn't mean that other holidays won't be observed or other books of Tanakh won't be learned. But the messages of the Megillah and the observance of Purim are things that are eternal. In many of the books of the prophets, so they address particular situations that applied in the times that the prophets were relaying their prophecy and are relevant to us while we're in exile, but maybe less relevant during the final Geula. But Megillas Esther and Purim will always be observed. So even though it's a story that we learn about from the earliest days in our youth, it's a story with limitless depth, and it's something that's really, really eternal. So tonight I'd like to give a little bit of the background of the Megillah itself, and I focus on the first chapter, and in particular, the character of Ahasuerus. If you were to ask people who the main character of the Megillah is, so it's called Megillas Esther, so I think it's fair to say that Esther is the main character. You could say Mordechai, Haman, but you could make the argument that really Ahasuerus is not the hero of the story by any means, but the main character, the central character. You could argue with that. You could say there are other characters. You know, think again, it's called Megillas Esther, so Esther and Mordechai are very central as well. But Ahasuerus, he's the first character we meet, and really the whole events of Purim really come from the decisions he makes, and really centered in many ways around him. So I want to take a look at, you know, who was Ahasuerus? How did he get where he was? And what was driving his actions? And if we take a closer look at them, again, we know these stories, we can almost, you know, say it by heart, but if we take a closer look, we see Ahasuerus's actions, even from the first chapter, are really very bizarre. I mean, it's not just that, you know, he's a drunkard. I mean, they really see that he's displaying bizarre behavior. So, you know, we'll take a look at a little bit what's driving that. And in particular, why did he throw this party? The Megillah just opens with the description of this party. And it's even that the description of the party itself is, you know, absolutely incredible. It's not just, you know, a royal party, but he wanted to show off in such a, you know, ostentatious type of way. So what was he trying to do at that party? What was the occasion for the party? And why was he so incensed by Vashti's refusal? And just in general, how does this set the stage for the miracle that, you know, we can tell later on was already unfolding? So just a little bit of a background of Megillas Esther. When did it take place? Who wrote it? So it, according to at least the more dominant opinion in the Talmud, it takes place between the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash and the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. It takes place really closer to the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. In fact, some of the actions of the wicked people in the story reflect that they think that the return to Yerushalayim and the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash won't happen. So that's when it happens, and that's so the dating, at least according to the Jewish calendar, is in between the years 3395 and 3406 or 366 BC to 355 BC. And just a note about that there's a certain about 157 years that are inconsistent between the Jewish calendar, meaning let's say we say the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in 423 BC. According to the secular historians, was 580. So there's a lot of discussion about that. But if you notice the dates are a little bit earlier, it goes, this is really according to the Seder Olam, the Jewish tradition of the dates. So that's when it takes place. And who wrote Megillas Esther? And who wrote Megillas Esther?
Mordechai.
Mordechai. Why do you think Mordechai wrote it?
It says so.
So I think there's basis for that. If you look at the first source, this is the ninth chapter of the Megillah. It says, and it's the second time it mentions some writing down of the events that happened. It says, "V'tiktov Esther Hamalka Bas Avichail Mordechai HaYehudi Es Kol Tokev L'Kayev Es Esigeres HaPurim Azos HaSheni." So they wrote the second letter of Purim, and it was "V'tiktov Esther Hamalka." So Esther wrote it, and Mordechai. So it sounds like a collaborative work between Esther and Mordechai, which, you know, would make sense because they were the key players. There's a question though: how do they know certain events that they weren't present at? How did they know what happened at the party? So the Gemara has a discussion about who wrote it, because the Gemara in Bava Basra number two says that the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, the men of the Great Assembly, who were in the basically the early Second Temple period, wrote down Yechezkel, Treyasar, the 12 minor prophets, and Megillas Esther. So which one is it? Was it Mordechai and Esther wrote it down? Or was it the men of the Great Assembly, which would have been sometime later? So the Gemara and Megillah tells us about the publishing process of Megillas Esther. First, Esther wrote it down, and she sent to the sages that she wanted this to be part of Tanakh, or included in the holy writings, the Sifrei Kodesh. But they said that based on a verse in Mishlei, in the book of Proverbs, Shlomo HaMelech says, "V'alo kasafti lecha shalishim," that there's a reference that the accounts of a Amalek, or the eternal battle with a Amalek, is written down three times. So it's written twice in Chumash, and one in Navi, in Sefer Shmuel. So they interpreted that verse as an instruction that the events of the battle with Amalek, which, you know, Haman was really descendant of Amalek, and the events of Purim are really the battle between the Jews and Amalek. So they said, we can only do three, not four. So, but then they said that the two that are mentioned in Chumash can be considered one. Then you have one in the Nevi'im in Sefer Shmuel, and then we can still have one in the Ksuvim, in the section of the writings in Megillas Esther. So that was basically the process of the canonization of Megillas Esther in Tanakh. that at first they wrote it as a historical document or just a record of what happened. Esther wanted it to be included in Tanakh. And after this discussion, so the sages included in Tanakh. And there's an idea that everything in Tanakh is written with Ruach HaKodesh. So it could be that you know they knew they were privy to events that they weren't present at. So that's how we can explain how they wrote it, even though they weren't present at all of the events in the Megillah. And the Megillah is an unusual book in Tanakh because it doesn't have any mention of Hashem's name. Right, this thing that everyone talks about, the Megillah doesn't have any mention of Hashem's name. There's an idea that when it says HaMelech, so then it refers that it's an allusion to Hashem, but it doesn't mention Hashem's name. So there's the standard explanation is that the Megillah is an example of when Hashem is hidden. That's even based on a pasuk in Chumash that alludes to Esther, that it's time of Hester Panim, of God hiding his face. And that's why the name of God isn't mentioned in the Megillah. The Ibn Ezra suggests more of a practical reason why Mordechai and Esther didn't include Hashem's name. He said that this was a document, the record of the events that happened. And it was going to be publicized and written down in the Persian history books. And they realized that this event was extraordinary. So they would attach the name of their king or their deity to it. So Mordechai thought if they were going to do that, it was going to get into the wrong hands and be perverted like that. So better not to write Hashem's name explicitly and just have allusions to it. That's a little bit of a background about Megillah Esther itself, when it took place, who wrote it, and then some of the structure. But now to the story itself. So why was Ahasuerus throwing a party? We have just a Megillah opens up. When he sat on his throne in Shushan, the capital, and in the third year, he made this whole elaborate party for all of his subjects, the officers, the generals, the army, the common folk. What was this all about? Did he do this every night? Or, and there were actually two parties. So what was the occasion?
Haven't he conquered something? That it was quite momentous?
Right, so the text doesn't say that, but it's clear there are a couple of different explanations of what the party was, but it's clear that this was both a victory party and an assertion of power. Because if you notice, it says, when did this party take place? It didn't take place as soon as he assumed the throne, but it took place Bishnas Shalosh L'Malcho, that in the third year of his reign. So what happened in the third year of his reign? So first the question is, how did Ahasuerus get to power? So Ahasuerus was, right?
He married him.
So that's actually a little tricky because Ahasuerus was the stable boy for Vashti's grandfather, and he was a commoner. Maybe having that position in the house of the king was somewhat of a distinguished position, but that was where he came from. But on the back page, I put the little chart. In this period, there were really a switch in power between Bavel, the Babylonian Empire, which is found by which is started by Nebuchadnezzar, and then the Paras Umadai, the Persian Media Empire. So Belshazzar, who was Vashti's father, was the last of the kings or monarchs of Bavel. And it became this Paras Umadai, this Persia Media kingdom. So Ahasuerus was in that kingdom. So it seems like Vashti was actually deposed, that she was part of the previous dynasty, and presumably lost her power and position when her father was defeated. So it's an interesting dynamic, and we'll see. That's why Ahasuerus was so incensed by her, because here she was from royal blood. She had a royal upbringing, but her father was defeated. Ahasuerus, who started as a commoner, is now this powerful monarch that's ruling over a massive part of the world. But how did, so if we say that Ahasuerus didn't start out as royalty, so how did he get there? So the Gemara says that from the fact that it says Hamolech, that he ruled, it indicates that he rose to power on his own. There's a question, is that maybe that's to his credit, or maybe it's an insult? You could say to his credit, because he was a skilled military commander and skilled politician, and maybe there's something impressive about that. Or it's a disgrace because he really wasn't fit to be king, but he distributed large amounts of money and that way rose to power. He bribed people. He was a populist and, bought his way to the throne in a time that was, evidently turbulent between different changes of power. So that's how he got to power. He didn't just inherit the throne, but he had a campaign that you bribed people, paid people off, demonstrated his power, his military prowess, and that's how he got to power. So why the third year? What was happening in the years before? So it says, Kishevas Melech Ahasuerus, that Ahasuerus was sitting on the throne, whereas literally was resting on the throne. So that indicates in the first 3 years of his reign, they were tumultuous years, that they were, he had wars with Hodu and Kush and different enemies. But then after 3 years of fighting, he was victorious and is now demonstrating his power. That's what he says. Now he's resting. So he's resting as a victory celebration. So he's throwing this incredible party. And you see this lavish party, this ostentatious party, and he's having everyone there. The people of Paras Umadai, his local people, but also the people from all of the surrounding areas. So what was he doing there? He just declared victory, and here he's having this party with everyone. The Pasuk says, who is there? The Chol Sarav Avadov and all of his officers and servants of Paras Umadai in Persia and Media and the nobles of other places. He invited everyone there after he was victorious. So what do you think he was trying to do?
Show his power and his wealth and consolidate.
Right. So you could say he was either trying to gain favor with them. He just conquered them. So he's throwing them a nice party. Or he was doing it to show that he was the victor. And according to the Malbim, that this was, like Mindy said, this was really a display of power and a display of victory. And if you look at what he did, so he was victorious. And then he gained power in all the other lands. And how did he arrange the people? So the Malbim picks up on the fact that who was there. If you look in source number 5 in Pasuk Gimel, it says, Asem Yishtei L'chol Sarav Avadav Chel Paras Umadai. He made a party, a feast for all of the princes and servants and the army of Paras Umadai. And then you have the local people. And then you have a part to Mimbisare Hamidinos Lafana. And then you have the nobles and the princes of the provinces who were conquered. So here he's showing that I was the victor, that we, the Persians, we're in power, and even the people in the lower stations in Persia, even the people in the army who are not nobility, even the servants or the slaves, they're all sitting in front of you. They're all have a more distinguished welcome at the party. And then we see after this he throws another party for the locals in Shushan. So this is, seems to be a display of power. He just, he bought his way into the throne. He had to deal with some fighting in the early years of his kingship. And then he expanded his empire, and he was showing who the king is. So that's one aspect of why he was throwing the party, to celebrate his victory and to demonstrate his power. But there's another aspect that's particularly in relation to the Jews. Why was he throwing a party? So the first exile was prophesied by Yirmiyahu that it would be 70 years. And after 70 years, the Jewish people would return to their homeland. So Achashverosh and some of his predecessors were aware of this. And so they calculated the years. There's a prophecy that they're going to return, so you have to be careful. But what if the 70 years pass and nothing happens? So then you think that didn't happen by now, so it's not going to happen. I don't have to worry about them. So Achashverosh's father-in-law, Belshazzar, made the same mistake. He thought that, just to have some frame of reference on the timeline, so when do we calculate from? When do the 70 years start? So Belshazzar thought that we calculated from when Nebuchadnezzar ascended the throne, because the Pasuk Yirmiyahu refers to Babel, to Babylonia. So Belshazzar thought that it was from when the Babylonian Empire was established. Achashverosh understood this. So what happened when Belshazzar thought that the 7 years were over? So the Gemara says that he said that if the Jewish people weren't redeemed by now, they'll never be redeemed. So he took out all of the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash and used them dressed in the garments of the Kohen as a display, a mockery of what the Jewish people lost and what he thought they weren't going to get back. But he miscalculated, and the Gemara tells how he died. He was given a divinely imposed death for doing something so brazen as to use the utensils from the Beis HaMikdash in his feast. So we see Belshazzar was wrong. But do we know that the 7 years are over? So Achashverosh said, okay, Belshazzar made an error, but I'm not going to err. And he calculated from, based on another pasuk in Yirmiyahu, that the 7 years start from when the king Yehoyachan from the Jewish people when he was sent into exile, because that was really the foreshadowing of showed that the exile was of the entire people was imminent. So Achashverosh counted from there. And that was the occasion of his party. That was his party was in 366 BCE. So he calculated from, it was a whole calculation, but he thought that now, okay, my Belshazzar erred and he was punished with a terrible death. But I'm not going to err. The 70 years must have passed by now. And we see that the Jewish people aren't going to return. And consequently, there'll be no threat. They'll be totally assimilated with us. And he's going to throw a party. And he threw a party. And he also used it as an opportunity to display his, what he thought was a victory over the Jewish people, by wearing the garments of the Kohen, and using the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash. And there's an allusion to that in the pasuk itself. In number 11, it says, Barosa as Osher Kavon Matuso, that he shows them the riches of his glorious kingdom, as he parti feres gdula so, and the honor of his majestic greatness. You have the words kavod and tiferes, the glorious and majestic. And those are the words that are used when the Torah describes the garments of the Kohanim, the kavod and tiferes, that for the glory and majesty. So just the words that are used are an allusion to the fact that this is what Achashverosh was doing. He was using the garments of the Kohanim. He was using the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash. And this was his brazen display of his victory over the Jewish people and the fact that he thought that the Jewish people would never return. And that being the case, so if you were a Jew in Shushan, or a Jew really in any one of Achashverosh's 127 provinces, so how would you feel about going to this party? Right? It's probably wouldn't want to go to the party. Anyone think that you should go to the party? Right. It seems like a terrible thing. Here this monarch is using everything that's holy and, you know, totally disgracing it. But the Gemara and the Midrashim say that the Jews were at the party. In fact, the Shimon Bar Yochai, the Gemara in Megillah, number 13, says that what's the reason why the Jews got themselves into the situation where they were condemned to death? How did they get into this situation? So the Gemara says that Nation Nenem Misudaso shall also arush, shall also Russia, that they benefited, they got pleasure from the feast of that wicked man, of Achashverosh. And that's, you know, that's why they, at least initially, they were condemned to death, because how terrible it was, how much of a disgrace it was to participate in something like this, both in just the, you know, the theme of the event, but also in the debauchery of just everything that was going on. But, you know, it's easy to say in hindsight, or when we're talking about someone else, that how could they do such a thing? You know, don't they have a sense of what's moral, what's right and wrong? But when you're in the situation, it's easier said than done. And, you know, sometimes if someone is in the situation, there will be ways to justify or rationalize a certain decision. So
they probably didn't know before the party all of the utensils were
going to be. Okay, maybe, but the party lasted 180 days, and you know they were going back. I don't know if you had like your hand stamped or something. You'd get in readmission the next night, but the party was going on. So what were they doing there? So there are ways, you know, we have ways of rationalizing things. So they said, you know, the party, and maybe it's not the best environment, but, you know, we order the kosher meal. Food's kosher. At least it's not, you know, completely not kosher. It says, this is the pasuk in Megillas Esther said, Hashasiya kedas eino nes, that the drinking was according to the law, and no one was being coerced. And it says, Harab beso lasos kirtzono ish vayish, that every person could do what they wanted. So there are different interpretations to this one, that no one was forced to drink more than they wanted to. Everyone was given the kind of cup that they wanted. But the measure says, what does it mean? Ein ones. It means ein ones b'yayin nesech, that they weren't forced to drink. The Jewish people weren't forced to drink forbidden wine that was used in idolatrous libations. You know, they were surrounded by idolaters, and she said, we don't want to drink that wine. We want the Manischewitz or the Barkand or the Bartonura. They were coerced. They got them the bottle that they requested. So, okay, it's, you know, kosher meal. Maybe not the best environment, but okay, they're not forcing us to violate the Torah. Now, could be that they were drinking Stam Yenam, they were drinking wine that at least was rabbinically prohibited. The Chasam Sofer says, either way, what was, why was this a cause for them to be, you know, condemned to death? The Chasam Sofer says that, okay, even if you eat not kosher food, so it's not a capital offense. So they say just because they went to this meal and maybe the food wasn't, you know, under the best hashgacha, okay, they didn't make them drink you know, wine that was used for idolatry, but okay, even if the food wasn't kosher, even if they, you know, did some things that they shouldn't have done, so these aren't capital offenses. So he says one could be because they had no regard for the rulings of the sages, as far as their decrees about kashrus, but the Gemara says how Mordechai and the other leading sages of the generation urged the people not to go. They're saying there was a bad idea, that nothing good would come from it. They're probably saying, well, you know, the food's okay, and you know, they're inviting us, but they didn't listen to the sages. The Chasam Sofer says that I think, like we thought in the beginning, that how could you go to something like this? Okay, maybe what they were doing there wasn't in and of itself the capital offense, but how could you benefit from it? It's chilul Hashem. It's a chilul Hashem to do these things in public, and it's a chilul Hashem to, he says, that the celebration was that Ahasuerus was celebrating that he was now able to defile everything that was holy, everything that was used in the Beis HaMikdash. How could the Jews be a part of it? And there are some who pick up on the formulation of the Gemara, number 13. It says, it doesn't say because they ate at the suit of Ahasuerus, maybe the food wasn't so problematic. It says, because they derive pleasure from it. It wasn't just that they, you know, that they were there or maybe were forced to be there, but they actually enjoyed it. And you know, sometimes we lose our sense of right and wrong, you know, bit by bit. First, maybe we're uncomfortable with going, but then, okay, it's a fun party. Everyone else is having fun. So that was really the problem. Maybe in and of itself, maybe they didn't eat food that was entirely forbidden. Maybe, you know, they were involved in other things, but the fact that they were there and derived pleasure from it was something that, you know, that Hashem decided that they, you know, that they would be condemned for that. And now we get to Vashti. You mind, the whole chapter is not very long, but we have all of these events. This is the whole, sets the stage for all the events to come. But now already we get to Vashti. So Vashti, who, as we mentioned, came from royal stock, and lost her power when the Belshazzar was defeated, but now is married to the king, and she was having a party for the women. So it sounds, you know, very, very tsanua, very from. But Gemara says that they both intended to do, you know, to do things that were immodest and immoral. So it wasn't each in their own way. Pointed out that Ahasuerus wanted a party with just the men because they wouldn't be, you know, stopped by their wives. And Vashti also was someone who did not treat women so well. The point out in number 20, the Gemara says how she wasn't such a tzaddikah. She would make women, the Jewish women, take off their clothes and work on Shabbos. And this was a measure for measure that it happened on the Yom HaShvi, on the seventh day. But both Vashti and Ahasuerus were, you know, two of a kind in that sense. They both had their plans. So they're having a separate party. And on the seventh day, so King Ahasuerus was drunk, and he says he calls his advisors in, and he says, "Lavi es Vashti amalka, bring Vashti here. Livnei Amelik b'teser malchut." before the king in her royal crown, laharos amim v'asarim es yofyaki tovas marehi, so that all of the nations and all of the princes and officials could look at her beauty because she was very beautiful. But Vashti refused to come, and this caused Achashverosh to be very angry. V'iktzav hamelech ma'od b'chamoso barabo. That his king became very enraged, and his anger burnt within him. So, we're so familiar with the story that we know, okay, it was Achashverosh was very upset that Vashti didn't come. Why was he so upset? Just think about it. He tells some of his advisors, go get her. Doesn't even seem like the whole party knew. She said, no, they came back. The queen doesn't want to come. Okay, why is he so upset?
Because she's disobeying him, where he's trying to show that he's consolidating his power, and then the queen doesn't respond to him.
Right. So I think that's a good point, that it's really more him as opposed to the embarrassment. But if you look at it, he goes, he calls over his chamberlains. Okay, maybe he still doesn't want to be embarrassed in front of them, but I don't, at least the way you picture it is, without looking at the details, is that here he says to the whole, the whole party, bring in Vashti, and she says no. But it doesn't sound like that's what happened. It's like there was a small group of people who knew. Someone went to get her, she said no, and you think he, even if he's drunk, he'd move on. But I think there's something deeper going on with their relationship. And you see, in light of the fact that he was not from royal stock and grew up as a commoner, so there's also, you see, and there's a medrash that records a conversation between Vashti and Achashverosh, that he was, he was still a commoner in his behavior. It didn't happen that once he became king, he started at least on the outside behaving in a royal manner. Because just think about what he was doing. Would a king want to have his wife come and Tamar says to come unclothed in front of all of his subjects? Do you think, if anything, if he's very power hungry, he'd be very jealous and protective of the power? It isn't like a royal type of thing to do, even though that's the case. Then, it's the case now, politicians, they carry themselves in a certain way, many times aren't so upstanding in their private lives, but at least as a public front, to not do this. But here it's the most, really acting like a lowlife. You're really the opposite of acting in a royal way. And this was something that that Vashti pointed out to him or reminded him of, meaning he knew that he had power now. He had the perception of himself as a king. But what if Vashti, what message did Vashti send back? So number 18, the Medrash says that you were my father's stable boy, and back in those days, you would bring naked prostitutes for yourself. Okay, maybe that's how people in those positions acted. But now you become king, and you haven't left. You haven't left your corruption. You're literally your ruin. And she was trying to hint something to us, trying to say, okay, now you're the king. You have the power. But I grew up in a royal household, and this isn't really what you want to be doing. So it said she gave him the hint, and he didn't take the hint, and she said she stung him, and he wasn't stung. Achashverosh didn't take the hint, didn't pick up on her subtlety. And here there's, maybe it's a little bit sympathetic to Vashti, even though it's clear that she was not she was a very wicked person herself, but she's saying, how low can you go? because even my father's defendants, Belshazzar's defendants, when they were, you know, being sentenced to death, weren't required to, you know, come before the judge unclothed. I mean, this is just, you know, such a disgusting thing that you're asking. And she also insults him. And it says when it says the next part of the pasuk, "Ve'iktsav ha-melech ma'od," that the king was enraged. So the Gemara says, "Amai de'loka be'kulehai." Why did his anger flare up so much just because his wife refused to come? And she sends a message, "Stable boy of my father," says, you can't hold your alcohol. Now here you are, you're acting like a boor. My father, he would drink the equivalent, he could outdrink 1,000 others, and he didn't become intoxicated. But you drank some wine, you're becoming foolish, meaning you're not acting like a king. And you can see that this was the tension between Ahasuerus and Vashti. Vashti came from royal stock and now was deposed and was only married to the king. Ahasuerus knew that, and even though he probably thought even himself until now that he really had the upper hand, but this was a reminder that you know, he was not really royalty, and that people knew that, people caught on to that, and that's something that enraged him, especially in light of the context that he was throwing this feast to celebrate his victory, and was doing it a way to intimidate the people who he conquered, to demonstrate his power, to demonstrate that he was now the ruler of them. And here his wife is telling him that we can see through this. I can see through it. The other subjects are going to see through it. And it's really all a facade. And then this next part is, again, it's a part we're, you know, familiar with. It's the closing of the first chapter, and it's kind of, you know, the wrapping it up. Then after this happens, so they send Vashti away, and then they make this law. But if we back up and we put ourselves in the shoes of his advisors, so what just happened? The king is completely drunk, and his wife just says, the wife just refuses to come, the request to come was just a very, you know, vulgar type of thing that I'm sure all these other people who were, you know, who were ministers and nobles in other places realized. So here, this just happens. And then Ahasuerus calls his closest advisors and he asks, what should we do about this? So if you were to put yourself in the shoes of his advisors, what would you be thinking? Sorry?
Like, calm everything down.
Right. You're kind of like a little embarrassed here because, you know, the king is totally drunk, and your boss is totally drunk, and he's asking to punish his wife. But what happens when he sobers up? If you don't do anything now, it's a catch-22. They say, no, just, you know, don't worry about it. We'll do it tomorrow. We'll, you know, take care of it later. But here he is. He's enraged. They have to do something. But they just, you know, say off with their head. So then he sobers up and he asks where Vashti is. So in the Megillah, we see that only one of the advisors spoke up. And the advisor's name was Memuchan. And Rashi, based on Chazal, that Memuchan is Haman, is that they're the same character. But we see this advisor, Memuchan, and what does he say? So Rabbi Yonatan Grossman points out that really it's a very shrewd, it's you know, shrewd advice. Everyone else is silent. They're you know, saying, what, you know, what should we do? He speaks up and he says, no, it's more than that. Lo alamelech levado avsa Vashti amalka. It's not only against the king that Vashti has done wrong. But all of the officers and all of the nations in all of the provinces. this is now a societal issue. You know, this is an issue that needs to be addressed for the sake of your empire. So, you know, that was just picking up on, you know, Ahasuerus's foolishness, the fact that, you know, they really couldn't reason with him. But then Mukhan goes and tells him, you should pass this law because this is going to be a societal problem.
Well, if he was having a celebration to kind of celebrate his expansion of his empire, and he has all these people, and they see that he can't even have his queen, you know, his queen is disobeying him, then, I mean, there is an aspect of him needing to assert his power to show these new subjects that he's not, you know,
right,
he is in control.
Right, that he won't tolerate any disrespect. Yes, yeah, so I think that's, you know, definitely a reasonable interpretation. But Rabbi Grossman thought it was interesting that he points this out, that you have to be careful if you're the king's advisor and you tell him to do something when he's drunk. Who knows? He would have woken up and not remembered and would have, you know, killed everyone else. So Mimukhan presents it as a national problem. And you also just think on, you know, the other angle. Okay, they get this decree in every single province. What's the new decree? You know, basically, if you ask your wife for a cup of coffee, she can't say no. Okay, but that's meaning this is the big thing that's coming out of the palace because his wife insulted him. So no, it made it to be a more societal problem. But it does give insight into just Ahasuerus's his character and his leadership. That you see throughout the Megillah, he really never makes a decision himself. He's always advised by other people. And Ahasuerus, he really never makes his own decision. Haman tells him something. His other, Harmona at the end, tells him what to do. Mukhan here.
Mordechai.
Right. His advisors when he has the dream. Then Mordechai telling him.
I said, what would you do to somebody that...
Right.
Oh, no. Haman says that.
So I think we do see consistently that Ahasuerus doesn't make his own decisions, and this is just shows an insight into who he was. And you know, why is this relevant to the events that are going to unfold? So I think we see that Hashem can raise us even when we're in the lowest place, place physically, politically, spiritually, and this description of Ahasuerus shows that we shouldn't be intimidated by our enemies, no matter how powerful they seem, because realizing that it's often a facade, that we think someone is more powerful than us, is persecuting us, but what's really going on in their head? What's really behind it? That's all a facade. That no one other than Hashem has power. They don't have power. And to remember that Hashem is always aiding us, even at times that we're completely unaware. Because think about it. When does this set off the miracle of Purim? Now, Vashti was sent away. Then Esther Esther entered the palace. This sets off the whole chain of events. And the Jews at the party had no idea anything. They thought that they felt bad about what they were doing. They knew that they weren't sure if the, you know, redemption would come. They saw that there was an all-powerful king, but behind that, all of what they saw was a facade. It was really all weakness. And what was going on behind the scenes is Hashem, who is the true king, was arranging events to result in their ultimate salvation. So I think this kicks off the Megillah, and God willing, next week we'll explore some more.
Oh.
Thank you.